Hello everyone, welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. Still in Cambodia, still doing the research. As you know, if you're listening to this around the time that it has been released. Today I have a very special guest, another discussion with Henry Lockhart. Some of you will know that I released a sort of two-hour, well, discussion is the best way to describe what that was, because it was very free-flowing. It was two people just talking about things with little regard for what a listening audience, who may or may not know what some of the things that were being spoken about were. So that's on Patreon. That, again, is for free on Patreon, the video of our discussion at the Royal University of Phnom Penh Library. Goes for about 2 hours. Like I said in that video at the start, during the sort of opening credits, I say this is a tough listen, but you can access that completely for free on Patreon. You don't even have to become, you know, a member of Patreon. You can just watch it. The link is in the description if you would like to, but as the video starts, you will be warned that this is, you know, it's not an easy listen. Henri is not a spring chicken by any means. He still has a sharp mind, of course, but he's a little bit hard of hearing and getting on in years. So there is a tendency sometimes for him to just float with his answers a little bit, but this interview I'm releasing on the main channel, this is a much more structured interview. This is less of a discussion. I sent him the questions I was going to ask beforehand, and it actually, the recording starts, he's sort of already answering the last question that was supposed to be posed to him, but we sort of come full circle, don't worry about that. But the thing I wanted to mention was that while the somewhat rambling conversation we had in the library had much better acoustics, this was recorded on, you know, the rooftop of a third-story apartment block in the middle of Phnom Penh. So it almost sounds like someone has a Phnom Penh soundboard and will randomly play sounds of Phnom Penh in the background at various parts throughout this interview. At one point, there's a child screaming. At one point, there's a car honking. There's construction noises. There's birds in the background. Various sounds that if you've lived in Phnom Penh before, you'll be familiar with. But perhaps for people with kind of a sensitivity to background noise like that, apologies. This is a slice of Phnom Penh that I hope doesn't diminish the interview itself too much. But listening back to it, I certainly found myself distracted by some of the background noise as and when it occurred sometimes. So just bear that in mind. If you thought the last discussion might have been hard to listen to just because of the discussion itself, this one might be hard to listen to because of some of the background noise that I'm afraid is out of my control, and my audio engineering skills, I'm not even sure if the best audio engineer could quite get rid of exactly what was there. So you just have to kind of accept that is the case. We're essentially recording in a public setting, and it was not the ideal location for audio. Now, I'll be upfront here and say that the four questions I ask, I start with what the slogan of the Khmer Rouge, a very prominent slogan they used, was the Super Great Leap Forward. I pose that slogan to Henri and ask him to expand on it. The second question that we eventually get to, with some tangents being taken in between is about the influence of Angkorian myth on Khmer Rouge policies, which was outlined in an article he wrote that was part of a compilation of articles that were released by the Center for Khmer Studies. So there he kind of challenges some pretty standard ideas about the Khmer Rouge and Angkor that I would say are his, you know, that he has strong opinions about. I wouldn't say that I necessarily agree with everything he said, especially about the sort of new research that has come out about Angkor using LIDAR and things like that. But again, that's part of Henri's thing. He has very strong opinions about some things, but unlike some figures in the general study of the Khmer Rouge, he doesn't challenge ideas in a way that diminishes the crimes of the Khmer Rouge. If anything, his ideas and opinions make the Khmer Rouge even more brutal than the standard story that many of you may have already sort of through osmosis generally have accepted about what the Khmer Rouge regime was. So Henri will challenge your view of what the Khmer Rouge regime was in a way that makes them even worse, if that was even possible, which leads to the third question, which is his speciality. It's something that he'll reference quite a lot. He'll say his book that has not been published yet. This has been his focus of study for, I think, at least 20 years, which is the detention center system of Democratic Kampuchea and, crucially, prior to the official, you know, start of the regime in 1975. His look at the provincial prison system, which he has written a book about, which that's been his focus for a very long time. That was what I set him up for with the third question, and he really expands on this idea in great depth at that point. So that's a wealth of knowledge for someone who's intimately connected with Cambodia. If you listen to the other interview that I released, you'll know that he was here in the 60s and for the last 15 years has been a lecturer at the Royal University of Phnom Penh. So this is someone with a very intimate connection with the Cambodian people. He can speak Khmer, and he's very worth listening to on some of these topics in particular. And when he challenges these ideas that have become the sort of standard understanding of the Khmer Rouge regime, I think they're very compelling. Now, the final question I asked is what book or which historian has made the most impact on our understanding of the Khmer Rouge? And this is where he sort of addresses, we just started chatting and he started addressing that question straight away. And I was like, okay, let's just start recording now. So he sort of starts with addressing that. And then at the very end, we return to that question, but in fairly typical Henri fashion, he takes it in a direction that I didn't realize was going to happen, and some more fascinating insights about the prison system come out of even that discussion. So here is my interview, rather than discussion, with Henri Locard. Again, if you want to listen to that prior discussion that runs for about 2 hours, that is on Patreon. Again, the link is in the description. You do not need to sign up or do anything. You can literally just click that link and watch it right there. So that's there if you want even more on Locard. But this discussion is a little bit more structured, as much as I could try. And I hope you got a lot out of it, because I've certainly learned a lot from him, to the extent that I'll have to rewrite sections of my book that I've already written to include some of his insights, which are, as I said, really challenge some of the most basic understandings that we have of the Khmer Rouge. So, I give you Mr. Henri Locard. And we're on our way. Okay.
So right, I can start.
You can start.
So when I first met David Chandler, that was in, wow, that's for you. That was for in Paris. And he was at that time working on his biography of Pol Pot.
Mm-hmm.
And Pol Pot was still alive in Hanoi Vang. And of course, I asked the obvious question, have you been able to interview him? And he didn't say heavens forbid, but he said with horror, interviewing Pol Pot, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
Which I think is completely mistaken, because Philip Short's book is much more interesting. Not more interesting, no, it's different. It's different, but it's really to the point for two reasons. Mm. One, he's a good writer. He's a writer.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
So that's very important. And two, he did a lot of field work and interviewed, went through the whole along the Thai border, interviewed the Khmer Rouge still in existence, and he picked up Phi Phuon. He selected Phi Phuon. Phi Phuon was the most interesting person because he lived from the very beginning of the movement to its very end, and was willing to speak. And because of his education, or rather lack of education, and total lack of sophistication, he was completely natural.
He just laid it all out.
So it just all came out. So
well,
that made it very interesting. And and David Chandler is a man of archives, a traditional historian.
Yes. And it comes across in his writing as well, which I find the more and more I read Brother Number One, the more and more I do come to appreciate how well he's able to concisely write. Like, very elegant, but concise and to the point.
Yeah.
Whereas, as you say, Short's writing is much more, it's flowery, it's full of description and and things like that. And but
I'm told, and he's too concise too. He tends, particularly his biography of Pol Pot.
It's quite short.
He's too concise.
Yeah.
Well,
everything is right. It's a bit too concise.
And I was told that his excellent writing has been, he's been very much influenced and aided by his wife. I don't know if this is true.
Right.
Well, that's what I heard.
Well, behind every great man is a great woman.
There is somebody. depending, you know.
Yeah.
Some wives have nothing to do with the work. My wife, not in the least interested in my research. She's a medical doctor, pediatrician. Yeah. Not in the least interested.
Some people are
completely different.
So someone like Ben Kiernan's partner at the time was a great help to...
She did the job.
Chantaboa
was essential.
Exactly, yeah. So that's a through line there as well. But for people just listening, I'm back with Henri Locard. This time in... we're not in a library anymore. We are on a beautifully adorned rooftop in Phnom Penh, just near the Olympic Stadium, not too far from Tuol Sleng. What suburb is this? What suburb is this?
A suburb, it's just the Olympic Stadium.
Not quite Bong Trabai.
Bong Trabai is much to the south.
Sort of to the south.
We are halfway between Tuol Sleng and the Olympic
Stadium.
So I can see, I can go to Tuol Sleng easily.
And we've got...
And see the director. And so, did you meet these two guys?
Yes. I met Hang Nisai. And then I met him at Tuol Sleng finally. Mm-hmm. And then I had the evening with the Australian ambassador. And when I checked in at the residence that evening, I noticed the name above mine, who just signed in,
was Hang Nisai.
Uh-huh.
So I had just met him a couple of days prior,
uh-huh.
and the ambassador had invited him as a means of sort of connecting us, but we already knew each other.
I still have not been able to convince them that there is not just S21 in Cambodia.
Yes.
They have nothing in the museum about it, nothing at all. And they never made an exhibition or interested in making an exhibition on the provincial prisons.
Well, I think now with M13...
But one day, perhaps, I might convince them, yeah. but I don't know.
I think with M13 now becoming a prominent part of mm-hmm. the heritage listing sites, I think they will start pushing at least M13. But we're getting ahead to of ourselves here, because people that listened to the last discussion we had will know that was two sort of, you know, Cambodia heads kind of just having a chat. This is going to be a slightly more, traditional interview. Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a few questions for Henri, and we're mm-hmm. going to get a few answers. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, the first question I had for you was, I remember reading your book for the first time, Pol Pot's Little Red Book. And the phrase that most stuck out for me of all of the phrases and slogans that you painstakingly collected and produced in this fantastic book was the super great leap forward, or the sometimes translated as prodigious great leap forward. What is it in Khmer? Do you remember? That's it. Now, for me, that phrase has been able to, it's almost a shortcut in explaining so much of the Khmer Rouge regime and their policies. Why don't you explain to the listeners, what exactly was the super great leap forward, and why was it such a popular and well-used slogan during the Khmer Rouge regime?
Well, none of these slogans were popular. They were repeated by the officials, by the Kamapibal and the Yotir, but I'm sure they were not particularly popular.
Among the probably population. The wrong phrase there, yeah.
They were repeated and repeated. Yes. They had to listen to it.
Yes.
Why? Because we were in the middle or towards the end of the Cultural Revolution, and it's the last years of Pol Pot, of Mao Zedong, sorry. Mm-hmm. The death of Mao Zedong, not the death of the Khmer Rouge regime, because immediately after his, it's in Pipuan's life story, because he went in the autumn 1976 on a secret visit, that was not an official visit, but a secret visit. And Deng Xiaoping told him, don't worry, we're going to help you as much as before. There's going to be no change. But there was, of course, a change. And they, when the Khmer Rouge besieged them to send some troops in 1978, and there was a big, I forgot the name, but a big leader, Chinese leader, came to Phnom Penh and said, we give you as many arms or weapons or tanks or aircraft as you wish, but no men. We don't want to repeat the Korean War.
That's almost like what the Americans said to the Lon Nol regime.
Yeah.
We'll give you all the money and the arms you want, but no troops.
Yeah, no troops in the end, yes.
Sorry, and Mao's death was in 76 or 77?
76, the death in 76.
76. Because that's also when Pol Pot 76. Sort of, he announces himself in this eulogy for Mao.
Yeah, yeah.
And
absolutely.
He announces that...
Yeah, yeah.
That Democratic Kampuchea is a country led by a Marxist-Leninist organization that he was the leader of.
Mm-hmm.
So it does mark this, yes, it certainly has this you think it's kind of a hinge point in the Khmer Rouge regime is Mao's death. But how does that relate to this phrase, the super great leap forward?
Because it was in China, it was called the Cultural Revolution,
mm-hmm.
and it meant that they would follow the Cultural Revolution, but even one step further, and make it more. For instance, collectivization. Everything in business was collectivized, but not your own private property. And in the Khmer Rouge, collectivized absolutely everything. You just had what, two shirts and two trousers, one toothbrush, one cap, but that was the your private property was finished to that. So it's a great leap forward in comparison to China.
And I believe it's in Philip Short's book that he mentions, so Pol Pot has this meeting with Mao before he dies.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a little bit indecisive on whether Mao seems both to encourage and to give the Khmer Rouge warning.
Well, I'm not sure about Pol Pot, but it's certainly about Chu En Lai. It's Chu En Lai who said yes. Chu En Lai was a curious individual because he was extremely aristocratic, extremely well-mannered, from a very cultured and rich family. He was not proletarian in the least, and that's why Sihanouk loved him so much, because he was the ideal flatterer, and he brought Sihanouk into the movement completely after Ban Lung. It was completely won over by Chu En Lai. So Chu En Lai, when he was lying in bed and, you know, for 6 months, dying of a cancer that was not treated properly because Mao wanted him to die, apparently. It's in these last months, I think Sihanouk met him and he warned him against, you know, going too far. But I don't think Mao Zedong ever did that.
Yeah, from my understanding, he seemed to say, oh, you guys are really taking it to where you're taking it beyond where we stopped. And he saw, the impression I got was that he encouraged the regime.
I don't know, you have to check that with Philip Short.
Yeah, yeah, I'd have to find
it. It must be Chu En Lai and not Mao.
He seems to balance both and say that, like, oh, okay, you guys are really going to go for it. And we held back, and you guys are going to try and make what our attempt was.
If you look at money, the work that this guy was doing on barter and money, in some ways, Mao Zedong also abolished money in the people's communes, in some people, and then they had tickets or vouchers or whatever instead. But they never abolished money altogether.
Yeah.
Similarly, people's communes. He created the people's communes and the model people communes, and the creator, what was his name? He came to Phnom Penh and he said, and it's in my book, he said, you realize in 3 years what I have not been able to do in 30 years. So this is the super great move forward.
Yeah.
But not the whole country was made of people's communes.
No.
They had not, and they sent many people, hundreds of thousands, even millions into the countryside, but not all the cities. Mm. So this is the super great leap forward.
So you're referring to in China, didn't collectivize everything.
They did not collectivize everything, they did not put everybody in people's communes.
Yeah, yeah. How do you reflect then on the super great leap forward being a phrase that I feel that the Khmer Rouge leadership they felt like they were being patronized by the Vietnamese in particular. They were always, you know, even the naming of their party, but we're the Khmer Workers' Party now, or now we're the Communist Party of Kampuchea.
Yeah, yeah.
We're the same as the Vietnamese, and guys can't look down on us.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you think that the Super Great Leap Forward is also an expression of their self-confidence?
Yes, we are doing it our own way.
Yeah.
We will not just follow you.
Yeah.
We'll do better than you.
Yeah, we'll do better than everyone.
than everybody.
Yeah.
We're going to be the big model for the whole world.
Yeah.
I mean, they got completely crazy.
Yeah.
And went from my, again, from the last book I was reading is the sub-director of the National Bank, you know, who was a Conchalat at that time. And they boasted that they went to, was it to India, to a big conference and lectured. It was Kisampan and Ing Sari.
Yep.
They were the big guests for this meeting of the Banlung Association, you know, the non
Banlong, we should explain what Banlong is for the listeners. This was like a
Bandung.
This was a conference in Indonesia
in
early 60s.
1955. 1955.
Which
and that's when completely Sihanouk changed.
Yeah,
completely.
It establishes this idea that you don't need to be neutral, this side or that
the
side.
The other side.
Yeah.
We're going to be independent. We're going to be neither west nor east. We're going to be free.
Yeah.
And anyway.
So later, there's a similar kind of conference during Democratic Kampuchea.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Ing Sari, Khieu
Samphan. And these young men. I go back to Dr. Sunisit, you know, his autobiography. They boasted that the Khieu Samphan and Ing Sari were the guests and presided over the ceremony, you know, in India, the big meeting of the Bandung Alliance in India. And they said, what idiots and what fools. How could the world be so stupid to invite this ignorant Muslim, you know, people who know nothing, who are the most stupid politicians on the earth, how they dare to lecture the whole world.
And this was during the regime or after?
Yeah, no, during the regime.
So people had
and they
an
were
idea.
The youngsters who were just 18 and 19 years old.
Wow. That's, well, just to
there were nobody in the country were fooled by their principles, by their theories. By the regime, they detested, they all detested the regime.
Yeah, but they themselves believed they had this confidence.
Yeah.
That they were, going to outdo, it would be the greatest socialist revolution that had ever happened.
Out of reality.
Yeah.
Living in a wishful world.
I often use the phrase unreality.
Yes.
It's the only way to explain the world they were living in. I did have a chance to speak to an ex-Khmer Rouge doctor a few weeks ago now, and he certainly remembered the phrase Super Great Leap Forward being repeated quite a lot.
All the time.
He was interesting. I'm not sure if we talked about this last time, but he was a doctor in Kracheh. So he joined the Marquis after Sihanouk's appeal to the people. He met a teacher that he hadn't seen since 1967, who'd gone underground, Comrade Yam, who actually ended up being the ambassador to North Korea. So quite a high-up figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this, who I have to keep anonymous, we call him Uncle Doctor Number One, he would have had it, if we're talking in terms of patronage strings and things like that, he would have had a strong sort of connection to this quite respected leader in the Khmer Rouge. As early as 1967, I think he was head of the Kracheh district.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, he said, I joined the revolution because of Sihanouk, but I believed in democracy throughout the regime.
Mm-hmm.
I was never a communist.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that if they knew that I wasn't a communist, that they would kill me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, okay, so if you realize that they would have killed you for your political beliefs,
mm-hmm.
he was unable to then express that same conviction that killings were happening anywhere else. He was unwilling to accept the idea that widespread killings were being were taking place across the country. Mm. He said Kratzer, every time he visited, was totally fine until Tarmac ruined everything. He blamed everything on Tarmac.
Mm-hmm.
But it was this, yeah, it's this unreality. It's this cognitive dissonance of him knowing that he would have been killed for his beliefs, for not being a communist, and yet he wouldn't accept the idea that perhaps hundreds of thousands, perhaps up to, well, 1 million direct executions, perhaps a million more people dying just as a result of the policies of the Khmer Rouge. He was unable to accept that. But, okay, moving on. Question number two, which I have... No, that is it. I remember now. About a year ago, I read a essay that you'd wrote... that you'd put together as part of a compilation of essays. I forget the exact title. It was something like Khmer Rouge and the Myth of Angkor or something like that.
That's just an article.
Yeah, yeah.
This is an article that was published in the Center for Khmer Studies.
Right, okay.
A magazine.
Would you mind... because I think there's a lot of... As you said, just before we started recording, you said one of the biggest misconceptions about the Khmer Rouge is that it started in 1975. I think another misconception, or perhaps not a misconception, but something that has come into common thought about the regime, is that they were trying to emulate the Angkorian Empire. 3 tons of rice per hectare, irrigation systems, things like that. And you get into this in quite a lot of depth in this article, and I found it very interesting that you sort of, how you explored that.
Yes, in that way, they did not follow the Chinese, the Maoist, who every antiquity was to be destroyed.
Especially during the Cultural Revolution, yes.
Whatsoever.
Yes.
The Khmer Rouge, we are so proud of their Angkor temples. They did, that's what I explained in Angkor. First, they did not evacuate the population straight away because they were making a 3-day celebration, victory celebration in Angkor with Buddhist monks from the Republican side and from the Khmer Rouge side. And this big ceremony lasted 3 days, which is a lot, with plays, with songs, with, of course, slogans, speeches.
And just to be clear, this is, what, April 20th, 1975?
That's right.
Yeah. So while people are marching out into the countryside in their millions...
No, it's 1975, and, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But at Angkor...
The people in Siem Reap, they were asked to stay put.
Wow.
First thing.
Yep.
The second thing... All the people of the conservation. Conservation is a pivot, you know, of the looking after
the temples. Yeah.
Which were about 100 people plus their families. Mm. Hundreds and hundreds of people.
Foreigners as well, or just come on?
They said, you stay put.
Yep.
You stay in your, because they were living in the center of Phnom Penh along the river in a certain area. You stay put. And 3 or 4 days later, they were taken by lorries, by bus, to small villages in Bakong district, just east of Siem Reap. And they were given good food throughout the country. There was a hospital, because all the hospitals' beds were put in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They had plenty of food. None of them were arrested, mm-hmm. none of them died, none of them were killed. The third thing, they, at the end of the regime, they had negotiations with the Thais,
mm-hmm.
and the Thais even, they were having diplomatic relations,
mm.
and they arranged for people to come and visit Angkor Wat, in the day, just there, by air. So they cleaned all the temples, they cleaned the city, they closed the prison, They made young people, because all of the Kongchala, the young people were cleaning everything, cleaning the temples to prepare for the coming of tourists.
Mm. Yeah, it's and something the, that Elizabeth the, Becker mentioned.
It was the fall of the regime, so it didn't start.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but they were thinking about, but, like, we need to get the tourism
next,
back.
And the following regime,
yeah.
And I was in 1989, 10 years later, and I visited Angkor, mm-hmm. and I was alone. From 1979 to 1989, the completely idiotic PRK regime never thought of using the source of finance
and tourism.
Of Angkor and having tourists in Angkor.
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
And so that the Khmer Rouge did exactly the opposite of their model, China.
Mm. And do you think that it,
all
that
the antiquities
literally that, trying to copy?
I've got some very good paintings,
yeah.
which I bought in China in 1966.
Yeah.
And I had a Chinese, and they are in my house in the Alps. And there's a Chinese lady who was one of the tenants who came.
Yeah.
And she looked at my paintings and said, oh, they are beautiful.
Yeah.
How did you get those? They're very valuable.
They're hidden away.
Because
during
they were selling everything. Because if at that time,
the Red Guard or whatever saw
beautiful things in your house, it means you are not proletarian, you are a bourgeois, you are a dangerous individual, then you could be sent to the countryside or to re-education camps. Because the Chinese, they sent to the countryside to re-education camps, and in their re-education camps, some were killed, but the majority were not killed.
Re-educated.
But
yes.
In Cambodia, no time for re-education.
No. I visited the high school that I suppose isn't too far
so
from
they had
here.
A very,
Bong Trabai High School, where they had a re-education.
All the visitors,
yeah.
all the important visitors, particularly in 78, 77, 78,
yeah.
were taken to Angkor.
Yeah, oh, like a all Potemkin village yeah, kind yeah. of.
And taking photographs and so on.
With Tion Prasit and those kinds
right.
of people.
Something that...
Yeah. So that's an interesting contradiction, isn't it, between the super great leap forward and this... some people use the phrase ultra-Maoist, I believe.
Mm.
Are you...
Ultra-Maoist, yeah. yes. Yes, in all other words,
but,
it's ultra-Maoist.
In this, except in the arts. Except for Angkor.
And it's one of the... most greatest characteristic of the Khmer, they are artistic. This man who just like he's making beautiful things all the time.
Mm. So do you think that this myth of Angkor, because this also extends to this idea of like the flag of Democratic Kampuchea has the everyone knows the red and the yellow
yeah,
flag.
We can be Angkor, we can do everything.
Yeah.
That was a very important slogan.
Yeah. But the other sort of symbol of the regime, I'm not sure it was like their emblem, I suppose you'd say, has this, I think you use it in the article, it has this a factory and it and irrigation
yeah.
sort of farmland systems within this emblem, which points again to, I think, another misconception that people have about the regime is that they wanted to live in the Stone Age.
No, I think they had a misconception about the irrigation in Angkor times.
Yeah.
And this is due to, what's his name? The last...
Not Grosselier?
The Frenchman.
Yeah.
The last...
The hydraulic city idea.
Yeah, the hydraulic city, that's
yeah.
right. It's a completely a misconception. It was his father Ponchot, who pointed, gave me the book of an agriculturalist.
Mm.
And this never existed. It's a myth. It's never been a reality. Angkor and the area of Angkor, there was water management for domestic use
mm-hmm.
and for religious use,
mm-hmm.
but not for having two or three harvests for irrigation.
Really?
Two reasons, it's impossible for two reasons. The first one, it doesn't rain enough. Okay. Half of the year you have not a drop of water. Two, the slope from Phnom Kulen is a hill, but at the bottom of Phnom Kulen, between the bottom of Phnom Kulen and the Great Lake, the slope is very, very, very gentle, almost no slope.
Yep.
And therefore, the water goes inside the land, doesn't flow. It's impossible, it doesn't flow.
See, this seems to contradict.
So it's a complete misunderstanding by what's his name?
Was it Grosselier?
What?
Grosselier? Philippe Grosselier? Grosselier? My French is terrible.
Philippe Grolier. Philippe Grolier, was the father, but his son, Bernard Philippe Grolier, whom I knew.
Right.
It's Bernard Philippe Grolier who invented
popularized
the myth of the
this idea of like a Venetian.
That's right.
Kind
and
of
the Khmer Rouge wanted to
like
reproduce that, but it never existed. They tried to reproduce something that had, and they made, and these young men, the Kongchalat, who were doing the water management system during the dry season.
Sorry, what would
they wanted?
Kongchalat, what does that mean?
Kongchalat is youth brigade, forward youth brigade.
Right.
From the age from adolescence to wedding.
Yep.
And sometimes you could be up to 40, because when they disrobed the monks, they were joined with the Kongchalat. It's until marriage.
Right, okay.
A marriage is a compulsory for everybody anyway.
Yeah.
And arranged marriage and forced marriages. Right. But during all these years, you are Kongchalat. And during the dry season, you were creating this myth, which you see in the symbol of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to work out how many tons of rice you could produce on 1 hectare, you had to make every field 1 hectare.
Mm-hmm.
Maromek, 100 meter, 100 meter, 100 meter, 100 meter. But the soil in Cambodia is never completely flat. So if you do that, the water has a tendency to go on one half of the...
It's almost shifting.
And the rest is dry.
Yeah.
It's completely absurd.
Okay.
So you had to take, to make sure that the thing is completely flat. But nowhere in Cambodia it's completely flat.
Yeah.
There's very, very slight slopes. And the what you call it, the little separation between the fields.
Oh, the dikes.
The what?
Dikes.
The dikes, that's right. The dikes, they follow the land.
Yeah. Yeah, not you can't impose.
You cannot
impose this onto the land.
The land to be flat like this.
I'm just wondering.
This terrace.
Because I feel like recent research by the late Damien Evans, he was sort of bringing back this idea of Angkor as this great, maybe perhaps 750,000 people, a million people. I thought he was kind of bringing back this idea that there were vast canals and people getting across.
When you say there were 1 million people living in Angkor, it's absolutely impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say there were 1 million people living in the western side of the Siem Reap Lake,
mm-hmm.
where the land, because it's bit near Ban Tie Minh Chie and Ban Tam Mong, mm-hmm. that the soil is very rich.
Yes, I was just not in Sam Lout the
other
day.
Not in Siem Reap.
I made a very big point.
In Kampong Tom. It's very poor soil.
Yeah.
And you cannot grow three crops on that soil at all.
Yeah, okay.
Because the soil has to be rich. And there were three crops under Angkor.
Yeah.
The first one is the normal, on the normal field, on the way to Phnom Kulen.
Yeah.
And you've been to Phnom Kulen. I'm sure you see the soil very poor, very sandy, or hard, not rich and soft. Now, so you have one crop there. The other crop is around the closer to the lake,
mm-hmm.
where it's more humid.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can have another crop, and the lake diminishes by 2/3, and the land abandoned by the lake still remains wet
and silty, and
so you have
good stuff.
A third kind of rice. So you could have three types of rice, but not on the same piece of land.
Right. Okay.
It's physically it's impossible.
Okay.
Because they over the lake, they send all the rice from Battambang and Battambang to Siem Reap to feed hundreds of thousands of people.
I guess before we move on to the, just on this same topic, I suppose I have one extra question, which is, so, but you're not, your contention isn't that the Khmer Rouge wanted to be like the Khmer Empire, but that they had certain ideas of how the Khmer Empire had the Angkorian Empire yes. had functioned,
and they were trying overwhelmed to emulate some of these things. And it's the French who imprinted that idea in their brain.
Yeah.
Because when the French arrived, there had been such, for centuries, a break between Angkor period and the modern period that A, they thought that it was another race, another people who'd been the not their ancestors, but another race or whatever.
Mm.
And two, that they were 2,000 years old, not 1,000.
Mm.
They are exactly contemporary to our cathedrals.
Mm.
Yeah, 11th, 12th, 13th century. They're exactly the same centuries. While we were building our cathedrals in Europe, they were building their temples in Angkor.
Yeah.
But of course, the technology of our cathedrals is infinitely better, because we know that you don't put one block against one block, above one block, they just fall down. You put them on cancours, I don't know how you say, you know, you put one here, and the other one in the middle, the next one in the middle.
Yeah, I think, well, even...
And they don't know how to do a knot.
Yeah, there's imagine, no archers at Angkor.
Archers were done before Jesus Christ in the Middle East.
Yeah.
But in Cambodia, they didn't know how to make an arch.
Couldn't figure the arch. And, well, didn't you know, Henri Mouhot, in his book, he said it was... Henri Mouhot, didn't he think... I feel like in his travels in Cambodia, he presumed that, yes, it was like contemporary to sort of Roman times that these temples must have been built.
Yes, they thought that it was 2,000 years old.
From the earliest times,
and Norodom Yukantor, it's called Norodom Yukantor, the young man who went to Paris, he was about in his early 20s, to protest against the protectorate, because the protectorate, when they signed, when Angung and Norodom signed with France, it was to establish borders. We talked about the borders, I think, already.
Yes, borders are always
we establish
a concern
borders.
For basically
but you don't
every
govern,
Cambodian
you don't govern
government.
Us. We don't need to be governed.
Yeah.
We just need borders to be protected from our neighbors.
No, this was when France
and,
was becoming...
And he said, perhaps I already said that. And you cannot teach us anything, because our culture, history is much older than yours. Our culture is older than European culture. So they are so ignorant. Ignorant about the couple of European culture, and completely ignorant about their own culture.
Okay. Well, let's move
and they could not read the stone inscriptions.
The Pali.
Imagine. It's in Pali and in Sanskrit.
Yeah.
But it's and the script is almost the same as contemporary scripts.
Yeah.
It's very similar.
Just imagine, lost touch.
Nobody in 1900, 1863, when we were up, nobody in Cambodia could decipher the stone inscriptions.
But they were still making the occasional royal pilgrimage. Like, there was still this connection with Angkor.
Wat, it's the only one that was still in use, and it was turned into a Buddhist temple. Only Angkor Wat was a little bit looked after.
Yeah, I'm just trying,
I don't want people to get the impression of
this idea that it was a lost civilization which was popularized sometimes by the French, but I think is another misconception that people have, which isn't what you or I are saying. But my next question is about your specialty, I suppose. So over the last couple of weeks, I visited Krang Thachan, which was Thar Mok's prison in Kandal, so the southwest zone. It was in operation from, I believe, 1971 or 1972 onwards.
That's right.
And I've also recently visited M13 in Amliang, so it's sort of just on the border of Kompong Spu and Kompong Chenang, which was Doik's prison set up in... I've been told Doik... This has been...
Never mind.
No, it's something that it came up at dinner the other night.
Yeah.
Where I was corrected on saying Doik, and then it was Deutsch. And then I sort of brought up, but there are other people like Hinton, Yuk Chang, they say Doik. Now I used to say Deutsch, now I say Doik. I've been telling people to say Doik, and now I'm getting corrected again. So this is my formal apology to my listeners.
No, you're just...
I may or may not have been saying Doik incorrectly.
It doesn't matter.
But as Henri says...
It's of no importance.
So M13's in operation from about July 1971. Mm-hmm. So this comes to your point of the regime is once the Vietnamese have essentially conquered most of the countryside and given the administration of it to the Khmer Rouge as early as 1971, 1972, certainly by 1973. Mm. 80% of the countryside is under communist control. So these two security centres, I'm led to believe that perhaps 10,000 people died at Krang Tha Chan, perhaps most of them during the regime. I would accept that. But M13, perhaps a very high death toll, perhaps in the thousands, no one really knows. But this is before April 17th, 1975. This is 3 to 4 years prior to that. So these are just two security centres. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe a lot of your work has been concentrated on the extent mm-hmm. of this prison system and how, certainly if there was one in the southwest and there was one in Amliang, mm-hmm. obviously there would have been one in the northwest, in the north, in the east, in the southeast. So I guess I just kind of want to tee you up with that. Your work on the prison system generally and get your opinion on just how vast this system was and how many people may have died in it prior.
All right, anyway, it was larger than most people believe. Most people completely ignore it because we have pointed out we have this huge museum in Phnom Penh and inside the museum they don't even tell you that it's just one of hundreds. Now, DC CAM came to the figure that was used at the tribunal of 196. Mm-hmm. I just finished this morning counting and I come to 375
prisons,
which I could identify,
security centers,
but it's impossible to count because what I'm told is that every people's commune had, for me, for the definition of a prison, is a place where you're confined, mm-hmm. one, and two, where you use iron knot.
Like shackles,
which is just a bar,
yeah.
and the rings
sort of, yeah,
that
sort of
slide
a
on the bars.
Yeah.
So you are tied with iron, and basically, I am told that every people's commune had its place of temporary. Where they were first interrogated, mm-hmm. and a lot of it, all this involved a lot of paperwork, because every citizen had to write his autobiography. Mm-hmm. So they had every citizen of the people's communes, the leaders of the people's commune had an autobiography for every single citizen. Mm-hmm. One, two. When they were arrested, they were interrogated again. Mm. Under duress also, mm-hmm. and put in iron, for a number of days. So with these two the old autobiography plus the results of the interrogations, they were sent to the local prisons where everything was done again, more reports and confessions. Mm-hmm. I just found one place where an individual wrote himself. Mm-hmm. In Tool Slang, they wrote themselves, mostly. Mm. They had to write their autobiography. In the provincial prisons, nowhere, except one example I found in one mm-hmm. place to write. But, so they didn't have, but that was an enormous amount of paperwork. Right, so it's virtually impossible, because I don't know how many people's communes there were. Mm-hmm. Normally, the people's communes at the beginning were one commune. So we know that in each district there were between 5 and 12 communes, each district. And for each province, you had 6, 7, 8 districts. Mm-hmm. So you can multiply. So theoretically, we could have up to 500, 600, 700 prisons. So this I could identify only about half of them.
Yeah, we're still talking about a number double than what is
the official. Probably double what I can identify. Yeah. It's impossible to identify unless somebody tells me or knows or can find out how many people's communes there were. Mm. Because in every, basically we can know that there was a place of detention in every people's communes, or temporary. Mm. Right. The other thing is, there are no regional variations. Contrary to Benkian, people like Benkianan repeat and repeat and repeat. And I've just been finishing with the East, Preveng, Swairieng, Kampot, Takeo. There were as many prisons in those provinces, which were supposed to be under Vietnamese influence and therefore milder. Mm. There's nothing milder about them whatsoever. And they were just as cruel and criminal as the one in Bat Ong Bong or Ban Chim Minh Chay or Siem Reap.
So this idea, I think a lot of people have this idea of, and you know, popularized by film and books, of people disappearing in the night kind of thing. But this would, if we're following your contention here, that it may not be that someone just disappeared in the night and was taken away and killed, but they were taken to
a prison
mm-hmm. and interrogated beforehand, mm-hmm. which would actually, someone like Hang Nguyen's biography, mm-hmm. that would comport with that idea. He was sent to a regional detention, mm-hmm. re-education camp where he saw terrible things happen and was tortured but managed to survive. Mm-hmm. But it would certainly comport with this idea that you didn't just disappear in the night. Mm-hmm. You were subjected. Mm-hmm. You were... I guess that ties into this whole idea of saboteurs and spies, and that you wouldn't just kill someone. You're killing them because they're a saboteur. And if they're a saboteur, they must have other people they're colluding with, mm-hmm. and conspiring with. Mm-hmm. So in that warped worldview, yes, you wouldn't just take someone away in the night and kill them. You would interrogate them, make them confess, find
all right.
out who they're
working
with.
So when people disappeared, the majority of the population believed they were killed straight away.
Yeah.
Some were killed straight away, but the majority were taken to the... Because before killing them, they must give their network, basically, as in Tuol Slang. Right. Now, the other difference with Tuol Slang is that, apart from one exception, they never wrote their own autobiographies themselves. Mm. Right. Now, the other thing which is very essential is that I believe that comparatively not all that many people died of starvation, less than what it is said, because you read people were stealing food all the time, mm-hmm. or digging roots or eating frogs. They were all very, very skinny, very weak, but they did not, were not starved to death. And in other words, more people were killed deliberately than usually is assumed.
Because usually the number roughly given is about 2 million, and then based on someone like Craig Etchison's findings, perhaps 1 million were directly executed by the regime. The other million is considered starvation, overwork, illness. And you think it's a higher number?
Yeah, I think it's much higher killed than starvation. Now, go back to Wang Tai Chan and Tam Kok prison. I have, and that connects with Monash and David Chandler and your university. When I went...
My former university, yeah, but yes, yeah. I'm an alumni.
Oh, you're connected with it. All right.
They still send me emails asking me for money, but no, I have no formal connection at the moment.
Right. Anyway, when we had this big conference for when, I think it was 1994, the end of the 90s, I forgot the exact date. When we had this big conference, it was on the history of democratic Cambodia in general. And I did my paper on Wang Tai Chan because they were extremely important prison for me because it's the only provincial prison for which we have archives. They are very similar to the archives at Toad Slang, and therefore they're representative of all the archives that have disappeared, have been deliberately destroyed. So they count for these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of prisons. Now, my paper has not been published, and I hope you will help me to publish that paper.
Yes, one day we're going to get this paper.
Yeah, because now I'm in the process of trying to find a publisher for my book on the provincial prisons. It has three parts. The first part is about 40, 50 pages on, well, the definition of genocide and not genocide, of course, this question of genocide. And, well, just it's a totalitarian regime. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I go into, I summarize what is the Khmer Rouge prison, what are the characteristics of the Khmer Rouge prison. Then I have province by province, it's a bit boring and it's very repetitive, all the prisons I've identified, and it's a series of testimonies. Some short, some very long. Some I have many ex-victims of the prison system, and I have many Khmer Rouge also. So some of these, so one possibility would be to make a selection and keep only the best testimonies, you know, the most interesting testimonies. I have already got rid of the smaller ones, the thing were just one or two.
And sorry, are you saying these are documents you found or interviews you've...
See, interviewed
former,
on the spot.
Former inmates or locals that knew what
there,
was going on.
There are three kinds. There are former inmates of the prisons, former Khmer Rouge, or people living next to the Khmer. And they saw
the
who was coming in and the local population.
Right.
Basically, there are three. And many, many of these witnesses are extremely interesting. Some of them, perhaps less, of course. But... some people say, well, just a series of, but the general picture I've got at the beginning of my book, and it's about 40 pages. Right? And at the end of my book, I have an analysis of about 30 pages of Wang Tai Chan, all the archives, who were the victims, what was their age, why they were arrested, what how they protested against the regime, and so on. Basically, they're the people who tried to run away from to Vietnam, because we are not very far from Vietnam. Or people, Khmer, Kampuchea Krom Khmer, who were badly treated in Vietnam, and they came and took refuge in Cambodia, and they were immediately sent to Wang Tai Chan, the poor guys. So I think this paper is very interesting.
Yes.
And then at the end, I have a few notes about Phnom Penh. And even S21. Some people I interviewed S21. So I have a few things on Phnom Penh.
So, yeah, I've often thought about it based on your work and I guess others, but primarily your work. That
And the book is about 370 pages or something.
And it's not out yet, so people, you know, keep a lookout. But I've always thought about it as sort of like a spider web, like a network of prisons. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a misconception that people have, like you said, that there was only one prison and it was Tul Slang. Mm-hmm. Where only perhaps 10 or 15,000 people were killed. But Tul Slang was really for the most important. If you went through one of these regional centers, then perhaps it was determined that, well, maybe this person does know something or they're hiding something important, mm-hmm. then they should be sent to S21. Or during the purges of the East Zone and places like that, if you weren't, you might have been killed at just some local high school, if you were just a regular Khmer Rouge soldier that had been deemed too close to the Vietnamese. But people don't realize that the majority of the victims at Tul Slang were Khmer Rouge and their families.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
And, yes, what the problem that the difference is that Dutch claimed that once they went through the gate of S21, he did not sentence them to death. They were already sentenced to death, right? Now, this could be true, this could be not true, we don't know. Well, the other thing is, when I was just rereading some of the declaration of Dutch and at the second trial, and he said that no, we didn't have connection directly with the provincial prisons. I wanted Nek Petra to work on this subject, mm-hmm. With a connection with the local, with the provincial prisons. Mm-hmm. We cannot, because we have to follow the hierarchy, and we are directly attached to the leadership. 870 office,
yeah.
And therefore we can only connect with it if 870 tells us to go and pick up somebody in the countryside. We do it, but we don't take the initiative ourselves. I don't know if it's true or not.
Trying to make himself as almost like a tool of. Just a function.
Yeah, yeah.
He performed a function rather
than
exercising.
But anyway, I was always understood that S21, contrary to all the provincial prisons, they could go and pick up any individual anywhere in the countryside. But this has never been analyzed, investigated. We don't know. From my interviews, and it's in my book, that person was sent to S21. So each time I wrote, when I have this, and if I write to Petra or Nisai, I send them, do you find their names?
Henri's just
and they usually answer me, we don't find it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that they have not been to S21,
yeah.
Because the list of inmates is not complete. Some names have been lost.
Yeah.
Right.
But you've established a pattern that existed across the entire country, mm-hmm. that challenges this regional variations thesis, and that really, I mean, it expands on this idea of just how brutal the regime was. It's quite compelling. You have to get this book out there.
I have to get this book published. One example from Kompong Som. There was a young worker in Kompong Som who was married to a much younger wife who was at least 20 years younger, very young work. And one day, with a couple of friends, two other friends, they could not stand the regime. Even the people who were Khmer Rouge did not like the Khmer regime, by the way. They could not stand the regime.
Yeah.
So they took a boat to flee to Thailand.
Yep.
And Thailand by boat is very, very close, right? But they were caught on the way, they were arrested, and of course, it's regarded as high treason, and that guy was sent to Tul Slang. A few days later, the wife, whom she left. He left because they had no children, and it was not a very, very close partnership.
So only the husband tried to escape.
And he left his wife. He sentenced his wife to death. By doing that, you know, they usually, the partner is arrested and put to death.
But if
you don't take your wife, you sentence her to death.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the kind of guy he was.
Right.
And a few days later, she herself was arrested. And she said, but I did not know that my husband was going out of nowhere. But she was taken, and she claims, to Tuslang. And then in Tuslang, after being interrogated and so on, she found herself out of Tuslang, freed from Tuslang, because one of the interrogators knew her husband or knew her.
Hmm.
So I tried to, I asked, I found no trace of this man whatsoever.
One of the very few.
And I interviewed, she lives in Puk district in Siem Reap. You could still, she was quite young. She was still a woman we can meet.
Wow.
If you're interested. Because I have never been able to really investigate that story.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, well, if you go to Tuslang today, you get a very standard story of seven survivors and...
Another one is Kalao, number two in Nesaran, that was for the Beaupier, for the northeast region.
Mm-hmm.
Nesaran was the leader, and he was one of those first one being purged.
Yeah.
And he's Kalao, who was a Jarai, the uncle of Bipuan, was summoned to Phnom Penh, but we have no trace of him whatsoever in Tuslang either.
Hmm.
And we probably, these people who knew they were summoned to Phnom Penh, what it meant, so they, like Sao Pim, they committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So he committed suicide on the way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no trace of him in Tuslang either. Mm-hmm.
Nicer arms.
So what I've been attempting to make relations between S21 and the provincial prisons.
Yeah.
I'm not in a position to, I found nothing.
Yeah, so
basically
I've described it sort of as like the central node, but that might not be quite the case. It might be that these, are you saying that perhaps some of these provincial prisons, they operated under certain guidelines,
The line of power, the Ksai, you know, the thread of power, was it Tuslang? 870, the provinces, or was it Tuslang directly to the provinces? I have no idea.
Okay, interesting.
And that's these two young men. This is the kind of thing they should find out.
So, and this,
I cannot convince them.
Henri's referring to Mr. Hang Nisai and Mr. Petra, the head archivist of Tuslang and the current director of Tuslang. Okay, so my final question for you, Henri, which is actually where we started our discussion. So for the recording purposes, we'll sort of be making a full circle here. But my final question was, I guess however you'd like to interpret it, what is the... which historian or which book do you think has been able to best shape our understanding of the Khmer Rouge regime?
I think I told you already.
Yes, but now you'll have to repeat
it. It's Bipuan, the history of a nightmare.
Philip Short. Yeah, history of a nightmare.
Although he's just a journalist.
I think
journalist of the BBC.
I think that might have been cut before we started recording. Yeah. So Philip Short is the man,
because it's a highly readable and informative and sound.
Mm.
I had some discussions with him, because he met me when he started his research, and I disagreed on a few points.
Mm-hmm.
He was right, or I was right, so he changed, and he's published a book which is almost perfect.
Yeah, it's my recommendation for anyone to get one book.
David Chandra, wrote, and it's quoted in my book, which is not yet published, but I want to publish, the difference between S21 and the provincial prisons is that in the provincial prisons, there was no writing. There was no paperwork. Exactly the opposite of the truth. There was a mass of paperwork. And Kantachan is the example. Mm-hmm. We know that, not just by hearsay, but to have the paper.
Well, and so at M13, I was led to believe that they were doing the same thing. They were creating the confessions, but they were burned, and that we don't have any of the confessions.
That's right, they've been destroyed.
Yeah. So that may have been the practice pre-1975, was to just get the confession, but then...
No, they were... It's post-1979 that they were systematically destroyed.
Post-79?
79, yes. It's the Vietnamese... Who were destroyed? First, it was neglect. People, they had to survive. They were starving, so they had reunited with their family. The members of the family had disappeared. That was the priority. Mm-hmm. Find food and eat. Mm-hmm. And then go back to their homes and repair their homes. All right, these were the priority, not collecting these scattered documents. Right, one. So neglect. Or they use it just for paperwork to make a package, right?
Yeah.
The second thing was that the people themselves, the Khmerus themselves, and these are all the proofs of our crimes. So destroy them. Destroy the written evidence that we killed hundreds of thousands of people. And three, even the invading Vietnamese, I have evidence in some places, they themselves destroyed the people. And the last, of course, one of the last thing, it's the job, the Vietnamese did the job, 100% of the job, which is understandable. Mm. I think this makes sense.
Well, I mean, and they did most of the job in 1970 and 1971 and 1972 as well.
From the beginning, yes. They created the Khmer Rouge.
Exactly.
And when I said, you know, for the creation of the Khmer Rouge, there are two internal causes, two external causes. The internal causes are, of course, Angkor Le, this group of five people, Pol Pot, Nguyen Chia, Khieu Samphan, Son Sen, and Yeng Sari. They are Angkor Le. You need Angkor Le, absolutely. Mm-hmm. One. Two, you need the king. Mm. If you didn't have the king, they would not follow you. Mm-hmm. So this is the internal causes. Mm-hmm. The external causes are, of course, the Viet Minh, who created the Khmer Rouge in the first place, and then the Chinese, who supplied all the weapons to the very end, and the policies also.
And the external forces you're talking about.
If you remove
there, go back to the
one of these four causes,
40s.
If you remove one of those four, if you don't have Sihanouk, you don't have the Khmer Rouge.
Yep.
If you don't have Angkor Le, you don't have the Khmer Rouge. If you don't have the Viet Minh, you don't have the Khmer Rouge. If you don't have China, you don't have the Khmer Rouge.
Well, I think that is about as perfect an ending to an interview that I could think of. Henri, again, it has been a great pleasure speaking with you. If you haven't read Pol Pot's Little Red Book, find it. His newest book, Jungle Heart
of the Khmer Rouge.
Jungle Heart of the Khmer Rouge, which is a biography of Pi Puan, who was Pol Pot's sort of closest bodyguard for many years, and a wealth of information. Go out and get that book as well, if you can find a copy. But aside from that, Henri, thank you so much again for coming on the show.